And welcome to Building a Private Cloud with System Center 2012 SP1 and Windows Server Jumpstart. I'm Simon Perryman. I'm joined today by Pete Zerger. And we have a very exciting day to really kind of show you the details of designing, optimizing, and planning a private cloud. And not just our infrastructure pieces, which is kind of the traditional thing you hear, but we're going to cover that, but a lot of focus on our service delivery and our automation. First, I'll introduce myself. I'm Simon Perryman, a senior technical evangelist with Microsoft, and I've been with Microsoft for about 6 years. The first 4 years I spent as an engineer, actually working on and designing a lot of the virtualization and infrastructure features around high availability, Hyper-V, and some integration with the System Center components. I'm also a VMware certified professional, and so I really want to encourage our customers throughout this event to ask questions during our live chat. So one of the nice things about you guys joining our live event here is you actually have access to us, the experts, so please feel free to ask questions through the chat dialogue and make sure that you answer the polls at the bottom of the screen. Now, if you're viewing this as a recording, make sure you go back to MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com so you can see some of our upcoming events and other live jump starts. But now, Pete, I'm going to turn it over to you, let you introduce yourself.
Thank you, Simon. And I am Pete Zerger, author, speaker, consultant, and MVP in cloud and data center. So I like to think that private cloud and hybrid cloud is really what I do. That's my day-to-day, frankly. So really hoping to, as Simon said, bring some real-world perspective to our discussion today. So really looking forward to the questions from the audience.
Excellent. Now, as we kind of look through the course of the day, you know, we have a lot of goals here really around designing, deploying, and building this private cloud infrastructure. Now, essentially, what we want to do is not just tell you, hey, here's all the cool features that we have, but really help you understand why you want to deploy them, when you want to deploy them, and really kind of the key design principles that we're taking from real-world experience like Pete has.
Yeah, that's a great point, Simon. We really want to connect those dots to help you understand why we do the things we do and when we do the things we do. So not just driving forward deploying a private cloud for the sake of deploying a private cloud, but really talking about who we're building this for, what we're building, and really why we're taking each step in the process as we move from the bottom to the top.
Great. Well, now let's talk about some expectations for the class here. What we really want to do is make sure that you guys have some good understanding to really start. Now, this is not an introductory course here, okay? If you want some of this kind of basic introduction material about what is System Center, what is Virtual Machine Manager, we would encourage you to check either TechNet or the Microsoft Virtual Academy for some of our other training. So we are coming in here with a few expectations that you have some basic understanding of the working knowledge of System Center and running Windows Server on top of that.
Yeah, definitely. So this is a level 300 session, and we'll try to establish some context where we can, right? So, but that's really going to be limited to probably 5 or 10 minutes every here and there, just to make sure you have some foundational knowledge if, in fact, something we're about to speak about is brand new to you.
Great. So, Pete, what are we going to be covering throughout the rest of the day here?
Well, so we're really going to approach our private cloud from the bottom up. So we're going to begin with the talk around our decision criteria, our planning. We're going to move up into building our cloud fabric, so the network, the storage, the compute, and talking about our options there and why we approach each of those in a specific way based on the criteria that we get from our audience, our customers, when we start. We'll move up the stack into self-service. We'll look at the automation. We'll talk about Orchestrator, the runbook automation that's really going to do the heavy lifting behind the scenes. But ultimately, we're going to get to the real goal of our journey, which is an intuitive self-service experience. So we use System Center's capabilities to abstract all of that technology from our end users to give them an experience that's very intuitive based on their understanding of the technology.
We don't
want to show the bits and bytes and LUNs and SANs to folks that don't speak that language, do we?
Sounds great. Well, let's jump right into it.
Yeah, absolutely. So if I could, I want to just plug shamelessly our session tomorrow, Thursday, actually, which is our move into the hybrid cloud. So there are a few things that I'm not going to share with you today, and I will happily point those out as we go along to encourage you to join us on Thursday. So certainly, if you're not someone that's leveraging Azure today, this is really not going to be a zero-sum game. There's going to be a lot for those of you that are still focused on private cloud as we move into that Thursday session. So definitely stick with us and come back for day two so we can really finish the journey.
Great. And if you are watching this as a recording sometime later, that same link that you'll see on the page will also work, take you to the recording on the MVA page. So if you sign up today as part of the live event, it'll take you to our live event. You sign up later, you'll still get the recording. So you can actually see this great content provided by Pete and Matt McSpirit.
Recorded for posterity. So let's talk about our schedule quickly, shall we? So today is a bit different than our normal Microsoft Virtual Academy session. We're really going to be targeting 90-minute sessions today since we're dealing with level 300 content. So we're going to be a bit more technical than we might be in other sessions. So our first session this morning will run from 9 a.m. to about 10:35, and that's our planning session. So we'll talk through those decision criteria. We'll move, after a short break, into building our cloud fabric. That's going to take us right up to lunchtime. And when we come back from lunch, refreshed, I hope, so maybe a light lunch, we'll move into self-service. We'll talk about automation. We'll work our way to the top of the stack, working our way out to meet our end user with that intuitive self-service experience in the service catalog. And, of course, we'll keep some time available at the end of the day for Q&A if we have any questions that overflow. I know I have nowhere else to be, so.
Sounds great. Well, we will keep this also very demo-heavy, so that's the goal. We've heard a lot of feedback from these Jumpstart events that you guys see plenty of PowerPoint presentations, so we are going to keep it light on the PowerPoint, heavy on the demo to show you some real-world implementations that Pete and his team have built out.
Yeah, absolutely. If you need more PowerPoint, you're free to send us an email. I'm happy to send you all the PowerPoint you like. It's absolutely my pleasure. But seriously, let's get into our overview for session one and just talk about where we're going to get started. So we're going to talk initially about our audience and our functional requirements. And by the audience, I don't mean you. You are our audience, but I mean your audience, your customer. So if you're in a corporate environment, that customer might be your business unit, your finance department, HR. If you're a hoster, that's something different. Not really important for purposes of our discussion here today. We're going to talk through planning our cloud fabric. So we'll look at classes of service. We'll talk about the special requirements for multi-tenancy. You know, when we have to coexist in the same shared environment, there are some special considerations to make sure we have one big, happy family. And we will, of course, talk about planning your infrastructure on Windows Server 2012. Lots of great capabilities there, as Simon will attest. And we want to make sure that we not only talk about those features, but when and why we're going to leverage those features.
Great. Now, I think one thing that's worth mentioning, you know, why are we covering System Center 2012 Service Pack 1? I really just kind of want to emphasize that the Service Pack 1 release is what supports Windows Server 2012. So throughout this presentation, you should assume that all of the technologies we're referring to, Windows Server 2012, System Center 2012, Service Pack 1.
Yeah, that's a great point, Simon. And frankly, in the field today, if I don't have Service Pack 1, if I don't have Server 2012, I feel a little bit naked, frankly.
You're missing something, right?
There is something I need that's not available to me, so that can be really, really challenging. So, and many of you, I'm sure, are already running Service Pack 1. If you're not, you really want to make a move to get there in the near future. It's not a difficult upgrade to go from RTM to SP1. So if you're not there today, think about getting there quickly, shall we say. So any thoughts before we get started, or shall we just dive in?
I think we should jump into it.
Let's do it. So let's talk about our functional requirements. Let's talk about the questions we need to ask before we build anything, before we design anything, right? So before we get into building the fabric, we really need to understand who we're building for, who we're designing this cloud for, and what it is they need us to deliver in terms of service.
Now, you're a consultant, right?
Right.
Day-to-day, are these the type of questions that you go in and you ask your customers as you're working on a new project?
These are the questions I ask customers every day of my life. Because at the end of the day, we've all seen the sessions at the Microsoft Management Summit at TechEd, and they're great sessions, right, talking about Microsoft technologies in ideal circumstances many times. And I'm not sure where ideal circumstances exist.
But we're a perfect world. You're the real world.
So I am the imperfect world for sure. So that's something that you know I'm contending with every day. So I like to keep my focus on what my customers need, not building the cloud technologies for the sake of building something that's technically cool. And certainly, you know, Windows Server 2012, System Center 2012 SP1, very cool. But I need to really look at this through the lens of what it is my customer my end user really need. So I need to think about who is going to use this cloud. So that's really the first question. Is this a technical audience? You know, maybe I'm just building some self-service virtual machine provisioning for my developers who are virtualization aware, who have a pretty good understanding of technology, who don't need a lot of change management and approval, you know, between them and that virtual machine they need to provision quickly. You know, on the other hand, I might have a good use case that involves a business unit that's much less technology capable.
So when you say I'm going to build a cloud, what exactly does that mean? Like, what are the boundaries? What does this cloud do for this customer?
That's an enigmatic question, isn't it? So really what we're driving to build is a shared environment that delivers a degree of self-service based on the use case. So when I'm thinking about these use cases, I'm not really thinking about anything specific yet in terms of what I'm going to build in my cloud fabric. I'm really focused on what is it that my end user wants me to deliver, and what are the circumstances around that delivery in terms of performance, availability, features, and functionality. So I'm really taking it as a service-based approach, not a technology-based focus.
Great. Now, we covered services a couple times, and I see this is the next question. You know, what type of services are you looking for? Now, services use kind of in a lot of different ways throughout IT, right? It could be something that you offer. It could be a collection of virtual machines in what we call a service template. So let's just clarify, what exactly are you calling a service here?
So the short answer to that is it depends, right?
Okay.
So I'm going to unhinge my mind from self-service virtualization. That's going to be a very common use case. It's going to be a use case that we're going to address here today. But in the beginning, the service request, what it is my customer needs me to deliver, may have nothing to do with virtualization. They could be after self-service your resource access. Can you add me to a group automatically? Can you help me onboard a new employee by automating processes like sending emails to the folks that, you know, provision new computers and desks and phones? So I'm really focused on the service as the customer sees it.
So essentially, this is something that an IT department can offer an end user. And that end user could be anyone, right?
That end user could be anyone. That's exactly right. Okay. So many times that anyone is not, you know, somebody within IT, not somebody technically focused. So we really have to listen to what it is they want and then determine how we can best deliver that through a user experience that's going to make sense to them.
I mean, I think that's a good point. You know, as we think about this user, right, we can't think everybody's technical. We can't think everyone's an infrastructure specialist, an IT pro. We got to think about our human resources department or maybe real-world end-user customers, you know, mom and pop that are using a consumer device. So really important to try to define the customer so that you can optimize that experience for them. How technical are the questions? What level of insight and knowledge do they have? Do they have to go and fill in information such as what server they deploy that to, or will you just give them a list of drop-down, which is very quick and easy? So,
yeah, very nicely said, actually. So at the end of the day, I want to be able to bring my user, you know, in front of that screen and set them down and ask them to request whatever it is we built for them without my needing to train them extensively or to explain the interface so they can make sense out of it. At the end of the day, if I can put a user in that chair and they can complete the self-service process and we can deliver the service they need without confusion, without questions, without phone calls.
Training even. I mean, that's ideal, right? You sit them down, they know how to use it. That's kind of our optimal goal here.
Yeah, we want to minimize that training, though, because you can imagine if I build, you know, for example, that employee onboarding, and I have a company of 10,000 people with HR departments on four continents, and I have to train, you know, potentially dozens of HR folk. I want to minimize that training, right?
Absolutely.
So I call that minimizing deployment friction. I want to make this as close to a seamless process for them as I can. So we get those services, and we're not necessarily just carte blanche going to deliver those services exactly as they're articulated. We're going to take that process apart and determine what it is the user really wants, you know, at a deep level and understand how we're going to deliver that. So we'll cover that as we move along today. We also need to think about service level expectations, though, right? So we don't want to assume that, you know, five nines is our absolute requirement. We also don't want to assume that, you know, 9 to 5 is good enough. So we really need to understand when this service is going to be used and how. And that being said, you know, what type of interfaces, you know, does this customer work with today? Are they operating strictly through email? Do they simply call the help desk when they make a request? We definitely find in the real world there are folks that, you know, their interface is no interface. They're using email or the phone today. So we really have to strive for an intuitive experience at the lowest level.
That's a great point. But, you know, fortunately, as you're going to see with these different solutions, we do have different types of interfaces, right? As you mentioned, email, web-based interfaces. So great set of questions, awesome way to get set up. So we really want to encourage you, get your customers thinking about these as you kind of start your initial deployment. Because oftentimes, these are questions that you want to know once you arrive in the room, not have them go and start researching when you get there. So you can kind of get things rolling a little faster.
Yeah, great point. So now let's talk about what answers these questions give us. So we ask the questions, and maybe you collect those in the form of a meeting, or you go around Barbara Walters style, and you interview folks in depth, you know, one-on-one in their office. Doesn't really matter, but we get those answers. These are going to tell us things like what we need in terms of availability and performance in our cloud fabric. We might find that some of these neighbors that will be co-mingling, cohabitating in our cloud, some may have very modest service level expectations, and others may have mission critical, you know, five nines type service level expectations out there. It's going to tell us a bit about our infrastructure sizing and what we need to build out in the network storage and compute layer down in the cloud fabric. Continual availability requirements if DR, you know, disaster recovery comes up. We may even see a need for data security or isolation. You know, that's a reality too, right? So HR no doubt has sensitive data, and if we're delivering some sort of new employee onboarding, one can only imagine there are bits of data.
Social security numbers.
Right. So absolutely, we want to sort these questions out beforehand so we know what our isolation requirements are. And at the end, we're looking to see what are those services we should develop in phase one. You know, the Microsoft marketing always says the private cloud is a journey. They're absolutely right. So good job, Microsoft marketing. And the reality is, we want to start modestly. We want to approach our private cloud with a use case that we can attack in a reasonable amount of time. We don't want to build, you know, Rome was not built in a day, and we're certainly not going to start with Rome. We're going to start with a small process over here in HR, and then we'll work our way up to something more sophisticated.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, people have kind of this view that maybe having a private cloud is binary, right? You have it or you don't. It's a process. It's a collection of resources, services, and just ways to go and manage your data center to really optimize it towards that model. I really want to emphasize that point. It's a process. You know, start with maybe new projects. If you have things that are working already in your data center, don't try tearing them down and rebuilding them. Kind of think about future investments, trying to do this cloud-optimized model. Then you keep your existing infrastructure healthy, but yet your new investments are really geared towards this new vision of pooled resources, self-service, automation, and those other great benefits of the private cloud.
Yeah, being opportunistic like that, it's so important and such a great idea. And as we go into those additional requirements for multi-tenancy, you know, we might ask ourselves, you know, is a cloud going to be simpler than traditional virtualization? In many respects, yes. In other respects, there are special challenges we need to deal with on the back end. So when we get those requirements together, those are going to signify some potentially needs for specific configurations in the fabric.
Now, you say multi-tenancy here. What exactly do you mean by that? Because a lot of people think, hey, I'm not a hoster, right? I don't have thousands of end customers. But multi-tenancy really happens in every data center, right?
Every data center. I have worked with exactly one hoster in the last 6 months. So when I say multi-tenancy, I am talking about a normal organization with business units, finance, HR, IT.
So the tenants are these individual groups within the organization, not
right.
Necessarily external customers.
Precisely. We think of them as apartment dwellers, living together. And so we need to make sure that we can give them the experience they need, and we can provide some boundaries. In terms of security and to protect our scalability and so forth.
And even quality of resources, right? Maybe your human resources department doesn't need SSDs and fiber channel storage, right? Yet engineering, they're the type of customers that we want to kind of separate those different business units towards.
Absolutely. And we'll actually speak to pools of resources so we can really optimize our fabric by not putting the most expensive ingredients into that cloud fabric. For all of our users, right? So to Simon's point, we might have users that need very modest needs, test and development, where I can use a pool of existing infrastructure. But then as we move into e-commerce type operations or customer facing operations, I might need those SSDs. I might need to scale out in terms of clustering and scale up in terms of of the size of my host so I can support, you know, more virtualized deployment there.
Great. Well, in addition to the security, this isolation that you mentioned, I mean, there's a lot of new features that came down in this, you know, release of Windows Server 2012, System Center 2012 SP1. Can you really kind of highlight some that you've really found important here?
Yeah, so a number of them. So really, the ones that I found most important are those that allow me to simplify the experience, not only from an end-user perspective, so that self-service portal. You know, many people will tell you Service Manager and the self-service portal are an optional component for private cloud. Absolutely not. Again, I feel like I have one arm tied behind my back at that point. I don't have all of the tools within System Center that make this so great. When we look at Server 2012, you know, we have SMB3 that gives us some high throughput capability. I can now put virtual machines out on a file share.
Reducing the dependency on shared storage and SANs, of course.
Really, really. And maybe I even have SANs in the background, because the other, you know, real key use of that SMB3, of Hyper-V over SMB3, you know, putting virtual machines in a file share, is I can really build a layer of abstraction between my data center admins that are my virtualization guys and my storage admins, my SAN administrators. So we're going to ease the interaction between the two. You know, at the end of the day, if I can deliver an experience that allows any administrator that can manage file shares in VMM to, you know, manage his you know, scale out into additional storage, we're in a good place.
Great. Now, I've heard a lot of investments around network virtualization. Now, we're going to spend a lot of time on that a little later. What's kind of the highlight of why you believe network virtualization is so important for these people?
Yep. So with Service Pack 1, with System Center 2012, which gave us our Server 2012 support, we have a whole new capability for virtualizing our networks, meaning that we can virtualize our tenant networks and put them into those apartments where they are living on top of the same logical network, but they're unable to cross those boundaries into one another's sensitive data, into one another's capacity. So I'm really, really able to draw some boundaries in a way that I wasn't before. And also unhinging myself from that need to build many, many VLANs as I scale out customers. You know, we have that challenge with VLANs that we can get out to 4096, I believe it is. And long before 4096, we're going to throw our hands in the air and say, okay, I'm done. This is just too...
Way too confusing. Way too much going on.
Right.
Well, I think one of the other networking features worth mentioning as well is quality of service, or QoS. This is a feature that essentially allows you to, you know, put a maximum bandwidth utilization on a particular connection, a particular network. So one challenge that we saw with these highly virtualized environments, you would have one particular VM on a host using all the network capacity. It was too noisy, that negatively impacted those other VMs on that host. So you made some improvements. There's built-in quality of service now using the Microsoft product, so you can actually throttle the maximum amount a particular user can have to really help with that multi-tenancy as well.
And not only built-in, it's very easy to configure. In fact, if you watch the What's New in Server 2012 jumpstart, that was handled by Rick
Claus and Corey.
Corey, Hines. Right? Yep. Just a few months ago, great quality of service demonstration in there, and surprisingly simple to configure. So worth going back if you haven't had exposure to all those Server 2012 features. We're certainly going to hit some of the key points in this session today, but there's a lot more out there for you.
Great. Well, let's move on and talk about some of the different classes of service that we have.
Yeah. So we'll get into how we're going to, you know, break up our cloud into logical pools. At the end of the day, we want to give our customers choices, our business units or our external customers if we're a hoster. But there is a lot of value in a limit to our choices. So we want to define our classes of service based on our needs. So those customers that have modest requirements for test and development, for example, maybe our developers that would like to deploy virtual machines for their testing from one development cycle to the next. We can even look at a resource pool for a group like that might be our existing infrastructure. So again, I don't need to bring out the brand new big bad hardware for everything. I may have some servers with Windows Server 2008 sitting there that might suffice in that case. And if we don't get, if you don't find yourself at a point that you're all in with, you know, every System Center 2012 SP1 component with Windows Server 2012 throughout your cloud fabric, that's nothing to be upset about. You know, certainly we're going to move there. It's a process, as Simon said. So I'm not going to hesitate in some of my resource pools at the lower end to leverage some of that existing hardware. You know, certainly if I have Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1, even if I have some VMware out there. System Center 2012 does a great job deploying to VMware, something that I see every week of my life out in the field. So many customers tell me, we like Windows Server 2012, we're going to get there, we can only handle so much change at once, right? So we're going to set the pace. And so no problem at all if we want to take some of that existing investment in what I'll call legacy Windows hypervisors. I don't think that does Windows Server 2008 justice or VMware, and I'm going to go ahead and proceed with my strategy using some of that legacy infrastructure, some of that third-party hypervisor in my fabric for maybe the lower end of my resource pools. And that's no shall we say, insult to VMware, right? I'm really just thinking from a friction perspective. This gives us an easy transition into a cloud-based existence, into a service-based deployment.
Right, and as you're going to see later in the day, we do have some great integration points throughout our management solutions with both VMware and Citrix with regards to managing the different hosts, monitoring them using System Center Operations Manager, automating them using System Center Orchestrator, and even deploying to these different fabrics as a self-service user using System Center App Controller. So a lot of great integration throughout the product. So you have these existing investments. Again, we want to emphasize you don't have to get rid of them. You can make this gradual transition, put System Center on top, manage both your VMware, Citrix, and Hyper-V infrastructure using a single solution, and then we hope you'll gradually make this new investments in the Microsoft Cloud.
Yeah, and I think the bottom line here is when it comes to choice, less is more. So how you divide those classes of service is not set in stone. It may be simply bronze, silver, gold. It may be development, staging, production. We can deal with that in a way that works for your environment, with the way your organization does things. But by limiting our choices, by creating some templates, so to speak, creating logical buckets for resources, we're going to avoid that paradox of choice. I actually out in the field saw a self-service offering put together by an organization in the service manager self-service portal, and they were really frustrated because nobody could use that solution. And the problem was not the portal, it was that they had so many choices in the portal. When we deployed a virtual machine, we had to select how many processors and memory and disks. It was very complicated, frankly, and so we really just needed to take a step back and think about our audience and what it was they needed to have delivered, what they were really, really expecting, and by creating some classes of service and building some templates so they could make a simple choice from two or three templates made this a much easier process.
Great.
So, out there in the real world, if we just talk about do's and don'ts, and the world is full of opinions, and I'm going to give you some of mine. Start by identifying some quick wins. So as I said, you don't want to boil the ocean as you try to do this. We all saw how Skynet turned out in the Terminator movies, right? So it wasn't pretty. It's not going to work any better for you. So really think about some quick wins, some small use cases. And I mean that specifically. I think of a small use case scenario that I can approach in a few days to a few weeks. I think about planning the right approach for each type of user in my audience. One size doesn't fit all in this case. So I might find that the service manager self-service portal is going to work great in some cases. I might find that App Controller is going to give me more flexibility for my more technical users out there. But again, consider utilizing existing infrastructure in your workloads. Don't wait for the new gear to come in to get started.
Now, what should people not do?
Okay, a couple of big don'ts. Don't wait for Hyper-V 3.0, okay? It's great. I love Hyper-V 3.0, but if your organization is just not ready, take a step into your private cloud on Windows Server 2008 R2, on VMware. It's all about delivering service in a dynamic way to these customers, about saving time, taking IT out of their way so they can just do their job, right?
So what do you mean by Hyper-V 3.0?
So I mean Windows Server 2012. I mean the latest and greatest.
The latest and greatest.
Highly scalable, many new features, very exciting. Stop me now.
And we actually just had a question come in that said, hey, I'm running Windows Server 2008 R2. Is this course still going to be relevant?
This course is going to be absolutely relevant. I'd say put Service Pack 1 on there. We had some nice ads on Server 2008 R2 with SP1. So get the Service Pack on there and move ahead. So everything we do here, for the most part, from a service delivery perspective, will ride just fine on the 2008 hypervisor. I will actually point out to you anything that doesn't over the course of the day, but by and large, I can't think of much off the top of my head that's not going to be deployed nicely to the 2008 version of our hypervisor. So the other big don't before we get away from this is don't focus only on virtualization self-service. Virtual machine provisioning or provisioning services, as you'll see today, groups of virtual machines, is important, but it's not the only use case out there. I've seen many wins in the field that had nothing to do with virtualization self-service, and we really want to focus at that point and just asking our customer, what is it that I need to deliver for you to get behind this, to sponsor me, to get my cloud into production? And it may be virtualization self-service, it may be something dramatically different. You know, HR and new employee onboarding, I've seen self-service security group and database access, I've seen mobile phone provisioning forms. You know, I don't care what it is. I really want to just find what it is I need to get my organization behind the solution.
Yeah, I really want to emphasize that point. You're going to see a lot of demos. You know, you might hear the traditional scale out to VM type demo. You could do anything that you can imagine, so long as we have a programmatic interface so that we could kind of automate with that, communicate through that, you know, using WMI, APIs, function calls. So at the end of the day, anything that you can imagine, any type of regular task your IT department does, you can build a self-service story around it.
Yeah, good point. I thought you were going to go into an acronym wrap for a minute there. WMI, API, OMI.
OMI.
I'm running out of rhyming acronyms, sorry. So let's jump over to the demo environment. We'll just have a look at the end result. So I want to show you an example of what we might see in a self-service portal that's going to be intuitive for a human person that doesn't maybe deal with technology in their, you know, day-to-day life. It's not their primary focus. So thinking about a user experience that's intuitive for the quasi-technical.
Great. Well, while you switch over, one thing that I just want to mention is one of the major changes that we have had with System Center licensing. Now, in the past, our previous versions of System Center, you would actually have to buy each of the products individually, right? You would just buy Operations Manager or just buy Configuration Manager. But with this release, we really wanted to try to refocus and say, you know what? We believe all of these components within System Center are going to be critical for your private cloud. And so if you buy a System Center 2012 license today, guess what? You get all of the different System Center components. So even if you just want Virtual Machine Manager and Operations Manager, we're still going to give you automation with Orchestrator, self-service with App Controller, and as one of our focuses today, service management, ITIL, using System Center Service Manager.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, when the licensing changed, when we saw System Center 2012 become a single product, it eliminated a very important blocker. Well, we could do this, except we don't own Configuration
Manager. We don't want to buy this extra license.
Right. We don't own Operations Manager. So those questions are just gone now, which is fantastic. So let's look at our self-service portal here. And you can see here I have what we call categories of service offerings. So I've tried to divide these up into a logical way. I've even seen in organizations where instead of access and security, it asks the user a question. It says, I need access to something. I need to deploy a virtual machine. So these blue labels, you'll see as we go along, this is highly customizable so we can speak the language of our user.
Now, I'm going to hold you for 1 second.
Okay.
What exactly is this? What's creating this? What System Center component is providing this information?
Yeah, I've made a huge assumption here. Thanks. So this is the Service Manager self-service portal. So this is my portal of choice, definitely for those less technical users where they need a little more hand-holding, they need something that's abstracted to a bit more non-IT language, highly customizable, and gives me in the background approval workflow capability. I like to say there's always a need for a smart person in the chair with the right training and authority to hit the approve button, right? So I'm not assuming that I'm going to send people here and allow them to provision
an unlimited number of VMs, right? Take down your whole data center.
You may provision an unlimited number of virtual machines. No, yeah, definitely we don't necessarily want to do that. So we want to think about preventing sprawl before we get started. So I'll just drill down into my virtualization self-service. Let me just go back. I'm going to click into what we call a service offering. This will be your first sort of exposure to this. I'll click into private cloud self-service provisioning, and you'll see here I have a couple of request offerings. And I'll just drill into one of the more advanced. And I think this actually came from a customer solution we put together a while ago that was really quite successful. So you'll notice here that I'm asking the customer for a few things in plain text. So I'll call this my web app service, for example, and what I'm going to provision here is a group of virtual machines. And we'll say this is for my user acceptance testing or UAT environment. Now you'll notice here I have some cost centers. Now I'm assuming that most people don't memorize cost centers. I've actually put my cost centers in here, and they can drill down into the cost center to see a little more about the cost centers if I want. So I can...
It's built-in guidance as well.
Right, right. So in the background, and you'll see how we get there over the course of the day, but I can build in guidance here so the user can make the right decision without knowing all of the answers. So I pick that cost center, and based on the cost center, you'll notice here it's giving me some more information. So this customer had a pretty extensive definition of cost center, but you see it's all driven. Now imagine if you had to have any user, any human person type that in manually, that would just be absolutely untenable. And here I have my templates, so we can even give them guidance in their service deployment here by putting some descriptions into the templates. And yes, you notice that says VMware. So this particular customer, we were deploying 100% to VMware until the new budget came in July. So I'll be happily visiting them in a few days. And I'll just click through to finish my self-service experience here. You'll notice here it mentioned to me that I missed something. Another great point about Service Manager, it gives me the ability to validate all of my users' input and in plain language tell them what I need them to give me in order to service this request.
So I noticed you've pointed out that it has built-in validation. It's fully customizable. You can include additional links to information. I think really kind of what our goal here is to eliminate these questions that people have for the IT department, right? It's a simple form. You fill it out once, and as the IT pro that's sitting on the back end, you don't want to be picking up the phone, answering questions, typing emails. So really this deep level of customization, our goal is to free up your time, right? Fill out the form, get it right perfectly every single time.
Yeah, so what Simon doesn't realize is he just pulled out my soapbox, and so here we go. So when we think about service delivery, when we think about self-service, we want to think about ITSM, about ITIL, about closing the loop with our service desk, with the stakeholders in a process. So behind the scenes, what Service Manager is going to do with this request is actually log a work item, what we call a service request. So I'm going to have a written record of this request, which is going to enable me using native System Center capabilities to drive approval workflows, to send notifications to the right people at the right point in the process, so all of the stakeholders have the information they need at the right time to drive this process forward. At the end of the day, a self-service offering that generates phone calls isn't really doing its job, is it? This is about efficiency. It's about saving money.
Yep.
And depending on who you ask, a phone call costs a minimum of $25 on up to something horribly expensive if we're calling, tier 3 engineers, right? So think about all of that, ahead of time. That's really what we're thinking about on the front end of our our service delivery planning. I'm beginning with the end in mind, shall we say. So bear with me while I get refocused on the right slide here. So let's just jump into some planning discussions and talk about what it is we need to build. So we'll assume we have our questions answered. We understand what the requirements are, who we're building for, what we're building, and let's pretend like we are in a quasi-perfect world and I'm going to deploy Windows Server 2012. So here we have some scalability numbers. We don't need to spend a lot of time on this slide other than to say we have scale and feature parity with VMware. Do you want to speak, Simon, maybe to R2? Is there any major change we're going to see in terms of scale with Hyper-V in Windows Server 2012 R2?
Well, at this time, there are no scale improvements that have been announced. Essentially, what we found from our customers is these meet the need of 99.99%. However, we are still pre-release on System Center 2012 R2, Windows Server 2012 R2, so who knows what will be announced between now and the release date. So stay tuned, but you can still have some confidence. These are still the best numbers in the industry today.
Yeah, Simon's great at building the anticipation.
Stay tuned.
And we'll talk about some storage and file system enhancements. So Simon's already hinted at SMB3. We talked about Hyper-V over SMB3. We talked about scale-out file servers. We'll have a look at that hands-on in just a minute. Storage spaces is a topic we're going to talk about, simplifying our storage by providing SAN-like storage capabilities without a SAN. And not being a dedicated SAN guy, that's music to my ears, that now I can live in a storage world that suits me as an automation and service delivery person. Networking enhancements as well. So when we think about virtualizing high-scale workloads, many organizations today, and I've gotten over this fear a long time ago, many organizations today, we still get to those high-scale workloads, we get to SQL databases. Oh, we can't virtualize SQL. Well, yes, you can, actually, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have this level of hesitation for these tier one mission critical workloads. Now, the reality is, anytime you virtualize an application on any virtualization platform, whether that's Microsoft, VMware, Citrix, open source, there's still a level of translation that's needed from that physical hardware through the hypervisor to the virtual machines. There always will be some level of performance hit. Again, does not matter who the vendor is. So essentially, what we've done, though, is really try to optimize this performance for the Microsoft workloads, since our engineering teams sit together. If SQL says, hey, we're not quite efficient in this area, the SQL team can actually work with the Hyper-V team on optimizing that and really trying to provide the best platform for the Microsoft workloads. Now, give you a little bit of insight into the engineering process here. Anytime any team at Microsoft has to ship a product, we have to go through this painful checklist called the Common Engineering Criteria. Now, I haven't had to go through it for about 2.5 years, but back when I did it, it was 147 pages of checkboxes. Does it support IPv4? Does it support IPv6? Internationalized domain names, Active Directory? Now, that's maybe a quarter of a page. So, you can imagine it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of requirements. So recently, big focus has been all around virtualization, making sure that it meets certain performance goals around the storage, the networking, the CPU, the memory. And so anytime we ship a product, it better meet these requirements so that we can really say it's enterprise ready.
Wow. So I think I just came up with a new title for Simon. His acronym is AVN, Awesome Virtualization Nerd. Wow. So that was a mouthful. So thanks for that, Simon. Really the networking enhancements to drive those high scale, tier one workloads Simon was talking about, SMB multi-channel. So out of the box, if I can bring up Windows Server 2012 on new hardware, with more than one network adapter. I can put a pair of 10 gig NICs in there with receive-side scaling, and I can see a file copy, a virtual machine deployment going to a file share, traversing two NICs at the same time. And I can scale that out, right? Multiple NICs.
Yep.
And what's great about that is the configuration is relatively easy, right? Can you show us how to configure that?
Probably.
Because there is no configuration. It's native behavior out of the box. We'll talk about the Hyper-V extensible switches and what that brings to the party, especially when we get to network virtualization. We'll talk about how we can make the provisioning of those switches a trivial matter. Certainly configuring our virtualized networking on top of our physical network, I don't want to trivialize that, but we want to try to make that as easy and as foolproof as we can. So we'll talk through that process in a way that I think you'll appreciate as we go through all of the configuration of our fabric today. So design considerations for the infrastructure. We want to think about our virtual machines, right? So what types of virtual machines do we need to deliver? What operating systems, what scale, what sort of networking requirements are going to have? Are we going to be moving a lot of data? If we are, then we might need to think about some of those networking enhancements if we're outside of the norm, shall we say.
Right. And of course, depending on what you're running inside that virtual machine, you may have different requirements. For example, if you have a SQL database that requires lots of disk I.O., you might have different types of storage interconnects than, say, you're running VDI that's just a thin client. So definitely important to consider, what needs to be optimized within that VM as well.
Exactly. And then we think about our virtualization host. And with our VM host, we have to think about what's that service level expectation from our customer? Do we need to look at clustering potentially? What sort of footprint do we need in terms of memory and CPU? We might need a host that has 32 logical procs and you have 256 gigs of RAM, it may be something fairly significant depending on, you know, how we're scaling at the end of the day. Physical storage, you know, many times with System Center, we don't really think of that as our problem, though. But, you know, but at the end of the day, we still have to interface with the physical network, right? So there's a conversation to be had there.
Absolutely.
There are going to be some VLANs that we create back in the physical network that we'll interface with through our logical network configuration. So we're going to minimize our use of VLANs. We're not going to eliminate them entirely. There's certainly a home for VLANs back there in the Cloud Fabric in smaller numbers that are a little less than the aggravation point, which is somewhere between 12 and 4,096. and then we think about our physical store. You're going to say something.
No. Go right ahead.
Simon gave me that look. I'm not sure. you know, we'll think about physical storage in terms of classes of service as well. Are we thinking about fiber channel, you know, fiber channel over Ethernet, maybe getting a little more economical with iSCSI, or maybe getting more economical still with something like storage spaces, which we'll talk about in a bit. Developing those classes of service we were talking about. Again, we want something that's manageable for us in terms of a planning and deployment perspective, and then from an end-user perspective, also manageable in terms of the information we're asking from them and the number of choices we give them. I heard a story in one of the TED Talks about a guy who went to the store to get olive oil for his wife, and he was greeted with an aisle that had 50 brands of olive oil, and he said, "I was so overwhelmed with all of these choices, I knew nothing about olive oil." He said, "I actually left the store because I was unable to make a proper decision. I couldn't get my wife on the phone, so it was just above my pay grade." and we definitely want to avoid that because it can be the difference between success and failure.
Right.
You know, when we build that first use case scenario out and we get in front of the stakeholders in that, you know, big meeting where all of the policy wonks are in the room watching to see if we meet the bar, you know, sometimes we only have one chance, and I've seen, you know, early in my, you know, private cloud career, I've seen a couple where, you know, it just didn't hit the mark because there just wasn't enough focus on you know, really tailoring the experience to the customer. So let's talk, and that being said, I wanted to bring up some other environmental constraints, and I have a feeling Simon and I will talk about this as we did last night. We need to think about the policies and the requirements within our organization. So every organization has security requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Some organizations have legislative requirements. So maybe they're not even your requirements. Maybe HIPAA or SOX, or insert your annoying, you know, regulatory requirement here. You know, we need to think about those before we start building, you know, because we build that experience that exposes sensitive data or allows a change to happen to a system that needs to be certified before we make that change.
And I think an important point here is this is planning information still. You know, we're still working on our planning. Critical to make these kind of design decisions ahead of time so we're not putting things in production that may not be compliant, may not be secure.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't want to get, you know, out into the deployment phase and discover that we have deployed something and made a material change to a system that requires certification, you know, for every material change. You know, definitely in the healthcare industry where I spend a lot of time, we see that there are, you know, classes of systems where, you know, we can't deploy a patch without, you know, some sort of auditor there to make sure what we're up to. So let's move into a new topic here. I want to talk about my favorite topic, perhaps, which is service delivery and automation. There's something pretty exciting here I want to show you, and that's the concept of services in Virtual Machine Manager 2012 and in SP1.
Now, service, let's quickly define the difference between an IT service with Service Manager and a service in Virtual Machine Manager.
Yeah, great distinction. So when we think of a service, we think of a group of virtual machines that are configured to interact in a certain way. They have particular network connectivity. We may even configure certain applications to be deployed to those virtual machines.
It's like a logical management unit. You know, I kind of like to think of that if you have this multiple tiers, this group of virtual machines that you want to, you know, manage those as kind of a single group sometimes. If you start up a service, you want to make sure that all of the tiers are starting up.
Yeah, that's a great point. I like to think of the service template as the next generation, the next level. So it allows me to manage those virtual machines as a unit. It allows me to manage their upgrade as a unit. It allows me to manage deployment of patches as a unit. So if I have a web farm with 10 servers, I no doubt don't want to patch all 10 of them at the same time, do I?
Right.
So a service template gives me that capability. You'll also see today the application deployment capabilities of System Center, and I want to show you how easy it is to build some of these application packages that I can then incorporate into my service template. So I'm not only deploying a group of virtual machines that are connected to the network in a specific way, configured to authenticate and communicate in a specific way, but also have applications that have been automatically deployed in that process of us pushing the button. So there are three what we call first-class application deployment technologies in System Center 2012. SP1, and I say first class, it's a fancy way of saying they're metadata aware. So you'll see as we work through our service templates that we have the capability to configure how these applications are deployed. We have web deploy applications, which are web-based, internet information server, you know, type web apps. We have SQL data tier applications, what we call SQL DAC packages, which means quite literally I can deploy a service template with, you know, perhaps a web tier, a data tier that has a sys-prepped SQL database instance that I then use SQL DAC packages to deploy databases to, and maybe multiple databases. I also have the capability of, if everything I need to do in terms of a deployment doesn't fit in this tidy little box, I also have what we call generic command execution, so I can run PowerShell scripts or even batch files. I'm embarrassed to say that the generic command execution I'm going to show you guys today is something I use all the time, and it's a batch file.
Nice.
But it works great. And you know, I think we want to really focus on delivering a solution that works, right? I'm not going to not use a batch file just because it's a batch file. It's there, it's supported in 2012. And I'll mix it up where I have to.
Now we keep talking about templates here. Kind of take it a step back to the theory behind this. Why should people deploy these types of services as a template? What's the benefit of this standardization?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a fair question. You know, at the end of the day, there were a lot of problems we had with virtual machine templates. So virtual machine templates did give us a predictable way to deploy virtual machines. What they didn't have was any sort of reference back to the template from which we deployed. So there was no way for us to trace the lineage of this virtual machine to see if it had changed in a fundamental way since we deployed it. There wasn't a way to fully automate all of the configuration and communication of groups of virtual machines together. So a service template allows us to take a service that might be an application, a database, or both, and to deploy that in a templated, a highly automated way that's going to minimize our opportunity for human error. It's going to give us a way to methodically update the systems within that template, and even as you'll see here in a bit, a way to not only, you know, update those applications as they have updates, but also to roll them back if something, you know, doesn't go quite right. Imagine we have our e-commerce web farm and we deploy a new release of the application and we get it out there, and for whatever reason, you know, our staging environment didn't match production and it's now just a disaster. I can click a couple of buttons and I can roll that back in a matter of seconds or minutes.
Yeah, one other thing that's, you know, I really got to emphasize here is just the consistency, right? You have a template, it's going to be deployed the exact same way every time. Humans make mistakes, right? And so by at least using this concept of templates to go and configure these complicated services and application, always going to be deployed, configured the same way, reducing time on troubleshooting, reducing these misconfiguration costs as well.
No, that's an important point. You know, we want to minimize the manual effort and minimize our chance to make mistakes. You know, I'm very, very good at making typographical errors. I'm a master, I like to say. So let's have a look at our service designer and just look at how these templates come together. I want to give you a visual image now of what a service looks like. So what you see on my screen here is a three-tier service. And just going from left to right, I have a web tier, I have a data tier, and I have a SQL tier, so just a standard three-tier application. You'll notice that down beneath there, they're connected to network adapters, which are linked into a network. So when I hit the deploy button here, VMM's intelligent placement capability is going to determine the best place within my cloud fabric to deploy all these systems, which may or may not be the same Hyper-V host. I've actually deployed a service that deployed to four or five different hosts based on that dynamic determination of where resources were most plentiful.
Interesting. You know, I've actually got one question here as far as where you can deploy. Can we deploy just to Hyper-V? Can we deploy to VMware? When we go and push something out to the infrastructure, do we care where it runs?
I don't care at all where it runs. In fact, many times we're deploying to VMware, and one of the templates I have that you'll see today is actually a service template designed around VMware. So we can bring that VMware infrastructure into our VMM console without fundamentally changing our virtual networking over there, not mucking about with the security on the data center tree. And I can leverage those VMware templates and deploy, you know, design and deploy a service to the VMware hypervisor, whether it's ESX4X or vSphere.
Right.
Don't really care.
Well, I think that's kind of the model that we're really trying to move to, right? We're no longer thinking about managing these single servers and keeping a server online. We're abstracting it, and we're thinking about the services now. And really, that underlying hardware, as an end user, as a customer, you don't really care what it's running on, right? You just need that service to be online, available, resilient.
Right. And as we make this journey into our private cloud environment, we know that our VMware admins are going to be, possibly a bit nervous about all of these changes. So this allows us, you know, to deploy to their hypervisor in a way that's going to be comfortable for them. So we don't really have to worry them about big changes in the VMware environment. We can just let them continue as they are. They're going to continue to use their existing management tools. We're just going to be leveraging their hypervisor for deployment so they can just do what they do.
Great.
So let's talk about service templates and instances. So when I build that service template, we've talked about, you know, the possibility that we can have multiple tiers within a service template. We've talked about the servicing capability. I can apply updates. I can roll out new releases. I can also define scalability within a tier. So we talked about a three-tier application with a web tier. Not unusual at all that I may want to scale that web tier out as demand increases. Marketing calls and says, you know, hey, Simon, we have a campaign rolling out. I expect demand will triple today. Can you help us out? Well, with a service template, this becomes an easy task because I can now go find that running service instance that I've deployed from this template. I can right-click on a machine tier. I can right-click on that web tier and select scale out if I have configured that tier to scale out. And incidentally, we configure a tier to scale out by checking a little box that says scale out. So really quite simple and giving us that push button scalability capability. And as we'll see when we move into the world of Orchestrator later today, maybe even the capability of fully automating that scale based on our monitoring of the performance of our service as we move along. So as we mature as an organization in our processes, we're going to have greater capability and comfort level with going into more fully automated scenarios to help us achieve, you know, solid service delivery and scale on demand. So why don't we hop over and have a look at a multi-tier service. So I'll just show you, I'll just give you a first look at a service template that I've configured that has some of these capabilities in here. Now bear in mind, I'm not going to hit you with all of the bits and bytes today. We've got plenty of time for that, and I want to make this easy for you to digest. So just as a first look, we'll have a look at my two-tier web and SQL template. And I'm just going to open my designer here.
Now what system center components are you using here?
Yeah, so great point. So I'm in Virtual Machine Manager. I'm in the Service Pack 1 edition. I'm going to zoom in for you here because it's a little bit... I'm old. Let's face it, okay? I'm just having my eyesight isn't what it used to be, so I'm going to zoom into the big type like my grandfather and I enjoy. So you'll see here that I have my MVA two-tier SQL web service, and I have configured a web tier, which was as simple as me adding a machine tier with a little button on the ribbon here. So I added two machine tiers. I, from my VM templates over here, found the virtual machine templates that I created for this purpose. So I actually have a couple. I have a SQL template. Very, very important capability here. So SQL 2008 R2 and beyond has the capability for us to sysprep a SQL instance, which means that I can sysprep SQL, so to speak, and then sysprep the operating system. So now I have a template that will allow me, in the context of deploying a service, to automatically configure SQL. So you'll notice in my template here, you see these little database icons. So I don't have to tell you what those are. Those are actually databases. And I'll just step you through the properties of the SQL tier. So, and maybe this will give us a little context around what a virtual machine template is. Mm-hmm. So when I think about a virtual machine template in the Microsoft world, it consists of our hardware profile, which is, you know, our processors, our memory, our disk configuration, and maybe even high availability. So I have the capability here to mark a virtual machine as highly available, which means if I'm deploying a service that's, you know, tied to some dollars and cents, if I want high availability, all I have to do is check this box, and I set it and forget it, and every time this template is used to deploy a service instance or to scale out, I always know that those virtual machines are going to be highly available.
Placed on a cluster. And I see you even have granular configuration saying, is it going to be high priority VM, low priority medium? And we see people often use those to start up different instances at different times, get the high priority services up, then medium, then low. So
right.
Nice granularity.
Right, right. And everybody wants thinks their services are high priority, but they're not all, are they? So we can make those determinations with the business in mind to determine how we're going to prioritize that scaling up. So the other sort of half, I like to say, of a virtual machine template is the OS profile here. In the operating system profile, I'm going to define things like how my computer is going to be named. I can specify a product key if I need to put a key in there if I'm not using volume licensing. I can join the domain. I can even provide an answer file. So if I am a deployment guru and I have answer files that I've been using over in the image-based world, I can bring some of that over here and leverage that in my template-based deployment world. Now I want to just preview for you here. I'm going to show you a couple of bits that you'll find. You'll see these in your virtual machine templates, but you can't actually use them. That's roles and features. So the service template gives us the capability to begin as we're deploying virtual machines. If I need a web server, I can literally check a box and automate the deployment of the IIS role.
Nice.
Ditto with features. So if there are certain management interfaces I'd like, to be present, off the shelf, if I need a certain version of the .NET framework there, I can make all that happen right here. So even more templated base capabilities that are going to allow me to automate the bulk of my configuration. So it's very consistent, very reliable, and technically much faster than I'm going to be able to do it on my own. And you can imagine just all of this, what all of this would take from a scripting perspective. I like to think of PowerShell as a very succinct language, but imagine if I were trying to orchestrate all of this in PowerShell. The scripts would eventually become immense. I'm deploying multiple tiers of virtual machines, databases, websites, configuring operating system features, turning on management interfaces. There's a lot of moving parts in here, and this template's going to allow me to make this very easy work. So let's have a look at the application configuration elements of this just real briefly here. So you'll see here that I've basically used the add SQL data tier application. You'll notice the other two, web
so
app.
There's the web, okay.
And I haven't mentioned virtual application. We'll come to that when we get out of the template. I think we shouldn't neglect virtual applications on the server side of the house.
Now what about security with these SQL databases, passwords, things like that?
It's almost as though Simon knew I wanted to talk about that. He's also a mind reader, I guess. So what you'll see here is I have deployment run as accounts. So I can configure credentials, usernames and passwords that are securely stored in my SQL database. They're out of sight, out of mind. Not everybody needs to hold these, remember them, etc. And I can specify those run as accounts in my template, so VMM will provide those credentials where they're needed to deploy my database instance. And these are some old school stock trader databases here that actually use SQL security. So my run as credentials here are actually a SQL login. It's not even a Windows, like an Active Directory user account or even a local Windows account. And you'll notice here we have some other little icons that I should just speak to briefly. You remember I mentioned generic command execution, so i.e. running a script. Generic command execution will allow me, in a SQL perspective, to run SQL scripts after I've deployed that data tier application. After that database is rolled out, if there's some config I need to handle after the fact, I have the opportunity after every application rolling out to make that happen. And let's just jump over into the web tier. We've come this far, and I don't want to go over here. I have to at this point. So I'm going to jump over and look at application configuration and just show you we have our web deploy package. We're going to look this afternoon at actually building a web deploy package in a SQL data tier application, and you are going to feel powerful when this is done. The first time I rolled out a two-tier service with an actual web deploy package and the database there, all done through the native System Center UI, through my SQL Management Studio, through Internet Information Services Manager in Windows Server 2012. Not a line of code went into anything I did. So I think you'll just be very excited about what the possibilities are.
So I want to emphasize, you're not a developer, right? Yet you're able to build all these multi-tiered applications, these service templates.
So, as an automation and service delivery focused infrastructure engineer, I like to think I'm pretty good. As a developer, I'm an infrastructure engineer.
Right.
So I try to stay away from I can spell C sharp. Does that count? So let's just look at the deployment process here. So we have time, don't we? Barry, Danny, we're good? Okay. All the time I need, all the time in the world. Not sure I believe that, but I'll take it. 20 minutes. All the time in the world, up to 20 minutes. I feel like there was a great offer that was just scaled back. And so you notice here that I can basically type in the name of my service, deploy, click the deploy button. Hyper-V is, if it's Hyper-V, if it's VMware, VMM is going to use that intelligent placement process to determine where this service needs to go.
I have a great question about the SQL stuff here regarding the service template. So I'm going to interrupt you here. Now, what happens when we have an update to SQL itself? A new version of SQL comes out, want to update our databases. How can somebody do that within this template and model?
That's a great question. So I'll show you the fast version of
even
that.
Even better, you get
with
to
in
see.
Play, with in-place servicing. So I'm going to show you the web deploy version so we can talk about how that would work on the SQL side, simply because restoring a SQL database is not going to be quite as fast in our servicing.
Well, one more SQL question here as
okay,
well.
Okay, fire away.
Now, what about if a SQL admin wants to go and adjust these service templates? How can we kind of configure control over what type of templates people can see and what the SQL admin can do?
Yeah, so we can delegate rights to our SQL DBAs to handle some of that configuration. Early on, I might advise against that. I'm going to have my DBAs build my SQL data tier applications because it's going to happen in their interface. But this will probably be a collaborative effort, at least in my opinion. I want to work my DBAs into that, but where mm-hmm. I really want to start initially, I don't want to overload them with the technology. I just want to bring them into the room. Guys and gals, let me show you something that works really well, that's really exciting, and I'll get them to a point that they're ready to take the reins from me and on a delegate admin basis, begin to configure some of their own service templates. So I kind of take that as it comes and again, base it on my audience. I'll have DBAs that are brilliant and motivated and much smarter than me, frankly, so I want to just enable them and get out of the way. So here you see I have a Windows service I've deployed with a service template. So I'm running just a simple single web tier application, fairly straightforward. Now I want to point out I've got a lot of tabs here, but I want you to see over here that the template release for my service template is 1.0. One of the really valuable points of the service template concept is there is always a tie from that template to all of the running instances that were deployed from that template. So I'm going to leave the VMs and services workspace of my VMM admin console. I'm going to go down to my library here, and you're going to see that I have a couple of versions of this service template. So if I'm looking at my Hyper-V version of my web app service, you'll see I have a 1.0, I have a 1.1, I have a 1.2. So let's just talk about in-place servicing. So when I configure my service templates, I can define the order that the tiers are serviced. And we'll get into some of this in a later module today, but I can configure the order that these are serviced and the pace. So if I have 10 web servers and I want to make sure that I never service more than, say, two at a time, we call that upgrade domains. I can set some boundaries for VMM so it knows how to behave during that update process. So I have a running service here, and what I want to do is upgrade my web app from version 1.0 to version 1.1. So what I might do is just have a look at the application itself. So I'll just pull up a browser here, and I'll go to that application. So that's Web 012. So there you see I have Contoso Web Service Template Web Deploy 1.0. So now I'm going to roll this service forward to 1.1, and it's dead simple to do this. So I'm going to right-click that running service instance. I'm going to tell VMM that I want to set the template. Now bear in mind, VMM has not done anything at the set template level. All I'm doing is telling VMM my intention to service this system. So I will pick the 1.1 template. And I'm going to have some choices here potentially. So this particular service doesn't have a lot of configurable values, but what I do have is the choice to determine an update method. So I can apply the update to the existing virtual machines, which in layman's terms means go ahead and just deploy the new web deploy package, update the application, and leave the VMs in place. The other option is to deploy new virtual machines. So maybe in some environments, if I have VMs that I'm just a little bit dubious as to their health, I could use a shoot and replace strategy. And this same sort of capability would apply to SQL data tier applications. So if perhaps as part of a coordinated deployment have updated your database schema, wrap up a 1.1 version of my SQL data tier app, put it into my service template, I'm going to service it in exactly this fashion. I'll hit the next button here. And VMM's going to do a little bit of thinking, and it just warns me here, hey, you only have one virtual machine. This could mean some downtime, kind of giving me some visual clues here that I need to potentially go back and perhaps scale out my tier or rethink things if I wasn't expecting potential downtime. You notice here I have the option to apply the updates immediately. I'm going to skip that, and we'll just go ahead and finish here. So now what I've done is put this service into a pending servicing status. So maybe I don't want to pull the trigger until after business hours, right? So I could fully automate this. VMM, everything I do in the VMM console is accessible in PowerShell. So I could, this could be a scheduled job after hours. This could be something a tier one delegated admin, a much less expensive person than myself, or so I like to think, can come back, right-click that service, and apply the template. So this is the go button, so to speak. So we're going to see that servicing in progress. This is a relatively small application that I built into this web deploy package, so it's going to update fairly quickly. So I'm going to cross my fingers and just jump right into the deep end and assume that this is going to work. And there we go. So you see that I'm rolled up to 1.1.
Nice.
Suddenly I get a call from the CIO's secretary. Pete, the CIO can't see blue. He has blue blindness. This release failed. I need you to take it back. When you talked about that consistency, that templated capability, it goes in both directions. So I've now rolled an application out. This release we've decided is not quite what we thought it was, and I need to get my entire service back to a known good state. Could be one tier, could be multiple tiers. I can roll this back. So I'm going to go right back to version 1.0 in my template. I just picked my past template, same process, and I can roll back as easily as I rolled forward. So very powerful capabilities that wouldn't be nearly so easy in a virtual machine world, right? If I were just deploying from VM templates, it would mean shoot and replace and potentially downtime, but at the very least, certainly much more complex orchestration on my part to coordinate all those moving parts working together. So that, in short, is really your first look at a service template, just a preview, shall we say, of what's possible as we roll out. And I'll go ahead and hit apply here to take us back to right back where we started from. And just proof is in the pudding, of course. We like to go back and see, we're in the middle of servicing here, so. Yeah, you have to forgive me there. I'm actually going to clear my template here. So I apologize, full disclosure, I actually broke that template so you could see the fail. But what it allows me to do also is clear the template so I can take myself back to my known good state. So I have a lot of options here with the service template to make sure that my services are in a ready and steady state before we're all said and done. How are we doing on time, by the way?
We're fine. We have about 20 minutes.
Oh, okay, fantastic.
So I'm going to actually answer one question that I've seen come up a few times, and that's with regards to licensing SQL for System Center.
Okay.
So just to clarify, what Pete's been showing is actually deploying SQL, and that's independent of what I'm going to be talking about, which is actually configuring the SQL Server instance for your System Center components.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we actually do is we provide you with one free license for SQL Server, full edition, standard edition, as part of your actual acquisition of the System Center component. So you get System Center 2012, you get a SQL Server license as part of that. Now, what you can do is all of these different System Center components, they can speak to the single SQL Server, have multiple databases within it. So all of that comes as part of your licensing package. You do not need to independently go out, purchase SQL, because essentially our goal here is to get you up and running as quick as possible.
Yeah, great, great. So why don't we talk about the interfaces in a little greater depth at this point. So we talked about the importance of knowing who your audience is and coming to them with the right experience. So Service Manager, as you saw, gives us a lot of capability to customize the experience, to limit the users, to abstract all of the technology. So we don't always want to do that. We don't always necessarily have approval processes. We want to give some of our more technically astute users that are maybe working in test and development environments or maybe in hybrid situations in both our private cloud with Hyper-V and VMware and Azure. So App Controller gives us a web-based interface, Silverlight, very easy to learn and nimble to use. I can just open a browser and I'm good to go. So the same interface in Service Manager that would allow me to deploy a service, I can use App Controller to deploy that same service. But also that servicing process you saw me going through in the admin console, I don't necessarily want my developers to have to contend with all that technology, but they can apply their templates to roll forward and roll back as they see fit in their development process.
Now, speaking about servicing, we have another question that came in here as well.
Okay.
Can you service a three-tiered application, multiple tiers? How would that work, picking an individual virtual machine or an individual tier here?
Okay, so we're going to have to go back to the UI so we can talk about that. That's a great question and worth mentioning. So let's just talk about how we update our template. So I'm going to begin. I mentioned that there is a tie back to every template that has an instance running based on that template, which means I can't modify that template. Once I've deployed from it, I now need to right-click that template and copy it. So I'll go ahead and copy my 1.1 template here, and you'll notice that it's going to give me a release of copy of 1.1. I like to keep these numeric, so it establishes clear lineage that's intuitive to everybody within my environment. So I'll knock that down to 1.1. Once it's telling me I already have a 1.1. So hey, smart guy, follow your own instructions. I'm glad my wife's not watching this broadcast. That would be absolute confirmation in her mind. That man cannot follow his own instructions, let alone mine. So I'm gonna open the designer here. And so if we were only updating one, you know, tier of our application, let's say you needed to fix just the web app or just the SQL database. Let's use the web app as an example. I can come in here and in my application configuration, I can pick that web app. And you'll notice here that the web application package, web app 1.1, is shown there on my UI, and I have a browse button. This is going to allow me to browse out to my virtual machine manager library, which is where I'm going to put my first-class applications. Those SQL DAC packages, those web deploy packages, are sitting in the library with my virtual machine templates, my service templates, my PowerShell scripts, and some custom resources. I'll tell you what that means a little bit later today. So I would go pick, let's say, web app 1.2. Not there. I'd go pick, you know, whatever version of web app I want to roll to. So let's say you wanted to roll back. It really, for purposes of this discussion, doesn't really matter. I have a new version of that web app. So when I apply this template to the running service, it's not going to replace all of the databases and, you know, if I have server app V applications out there, it's not going to replace all of the components that didn't change. It's just going to apply the change. So in short, if you have a database you need to update, make a SQL DAC package, come into your two-tier template, and browse out to the new SQL DAC package. It's as simple as that. So the answer is yes, you can, and yes, you can at a very granular level. Now, I want to direct your attention to the bottom of my screen here to our servicing instruction. So you'll notice that when I highlight a tier, down in the bottom here, we see an application deployment order. We see a servicing order. We see default and maximum instance count. So you'll notice here that the servicing order for my web tier is 1. Maybe in your environment, your SQL database needs to be in place to get your web app up and online, so I could just as easily reverse these. Doesn't matter. But each tier can be prioritized in terms of what my rollout, my deployment order is going to be, but also my servicing order. And my default and maximum instance counts give me the capability to define a scale-out tier. So it makes perfect sense that in a web farm we might want to scale out. You could just as easily scale out, say, a terminal service as a remote desktop services farm. Great application to virtualize. Fantastic session at TechEd 2013 in New Orleans for doing exactly that, building a service template that would allow me to basically scale out remote desktop services boxes on demand. Fantastic use of the technology. And so for anything that is a scale-out tier like that, I can come back to my running instances. So I'm going to go back from my library where all of my templates are. So I think of templates as really books or instruction sets. And so, you know, I find my instructions in the library. I'll go back to my running services out here where I'll find that multi-tier instance. And if I want to scale out a tier that's capable of scaling out, I can right-click, select Scale Out. That's immediately going to kick off a job that will scale out. So, and in this particular case, giving me the option to name this guy, or gal, if you prefer to think of your web servers as ladies. I am gender agnostic with web servers, so I'll go ahead and scale out. And there we have it. So that's going to roll out. And you notice the jobs window pops up immediately. So now I've got a deployment underway, and pretty quickly in my UI, I'm going to see that deployment rolling out. So there it is. And what's happening in the background there is a virtual machine template is being deployed into the tier, the web tier of that application. The hard drive, the VHD is being copied out of the library to the appropriate host. If this is a highly available virtual machine, which it is, it's going to go out to a highly available server or cluster in our cloud fabric. And I'm not thinking about any of that anymore. I made that decision back when I defined my virtual machine template. So thinking about the lineage of the process here, I defined my virtual machines, and then I incorporated those virtual machine templates into my service templates. So maybe while we're allowing that to cook, so to speak, we can jump down into our library and have a look at some of the profiles that show up here. So you'll notice we have the guest OS profile we talked about with the virtual machine template.
So guest OS is what's actually going to run within that virtual machine. So the operating system, the features, the roles, the user, passwords, admin account, time zones.
Yeah, behavior for joining the domain, etc. So yeah, in plain English, there you have it. And our hardware profile, so what that virtual machine will have in terms of CPU cores, or vCPUs, we call them, memory.
Right. I think it's important to know the hardware profile is the hardware profile for the virtual machine.
The virtual
not
hardware.
Not for the host. We have a separate profile for that.
Yeah. So that's a great point. And that hardware profile is also where we check the magic high availability box. So it's within that virtual machine template that we define our availability requirements for that machine before we ever incorporate it into a service template. So speaking of hardware, Simon brought it up. Let's look at hardware profile. So one thing we don't think about every day is the bare metal deployment capabilities of VMM 2012. So I have some capabilities down here to define some settings for bare metal deployment.
Okay, so what exactly is a bare metal deployment? This is interacting with the BMC, the baseboard management controller, right?
Right, so what I can do at the end of the day is manage some hosts out of band. So anything with a baseboard controller, I can reboot it, I can power it up, I can deploy a Hyper-V host from the bare metal. So give me a box, give me its baseboard controller. All your OEMs have their flavor of baseboard controller, right, that will allow me to manage out of band. I can move into the world of you know, dynamically. You saw me dynamically scale out of virtual machines here. Now imagine you have scalability needs that go beyond expanding virtual machines in your fabric, but you actually need to expand the fabric. I can scale out in the fabric and deploy new hosts from the bare metal. Now, bear in mind, that feature is only Hyper-V. I'm not going to be deploying VMware hosts from the bare metal.
Great point.
So, and, you know, so just running through these hosts, you'll see I have here some profiles I've created. These templates allow me to define some settings ahead of time for SQL instances that I'm going to roll out. So I can define, you know, in this case I've got, I was defining some credentials. So I can set up a few things ahead of time that make this an even more foolproof process. So these templates can be, you know, set up ahead of time so I don't even have to go bother my DBAs, my database admins, when I'm creating new service templates. They've defined potentially the types of SQL deployments we'll have. So as I'm building that service, I can simply pick what the profile they've already defined with me. So lots of capability to put this work on autopilot and not only minimize your deployment effort, but to minimize the face time and the manual effort you're dragging out of your database admins. And we all know that good DBAs are not a plentiful resource, right? So we want to be, you know, protective of their time, and this makes that a very easy process, frankly. Before we run out of time, I want to bring up virtual applications from a server perspective. So you saw virtual applications, and I didn't speak to that. We talked about web deploy apps, you know, basically packaging our IIS applications, packaging our SQL database apps in what we call the SQL DAC packages. But what are these virtual applications that I'm talking about? So this is Server App V. So just as I can sequence an application to deploy a virtual application to the desktop with AppV as we're accustomed to, I can do that with a sequencer on the server side of the house. So the sequencing experience is very, very similar. The behavior of a virtual application on the server side is a bit different. The way applications stream on the desktop just in time, we don't do that on the server side. We're going to stream all at once, and the boundaries of that application are going to be a little more fluid for interacting with other applications. So the technical details are not so important, but know that if you have applications that are low-hanging fruit for virtualization, we can definitely do that. We're not going to virtualize in this release things like Exchange or SQL or SharePoint, you know, massive tier one workloads, one step at a time, right? So we want to choose smaller middleware type applications where that might make sense. All righty, so back to these interfaces, just real quickly to tie this conversation off. I've been sort of beating the drum about, you know, providing that interface that's good for our user, and we looked at this interface at Service Manager, right? So we don't need to do this for everybody. Sometimes quick and easy and lightweight is going to be good for us as IT pros, as the fabric admins, I like to call us, or our developers that are out there rolling forward and rolling back, you know, different releases of applications, maybe waking up a virtual machine that they've stored in the library for the last 6 months because they have a patch cycle or a release. This gives my self-service users that are cognizant of the ins and outs of virtualization capability to manage their virtual assets. So from a cloud perspective, I'm only giving them so much capacity, right? I'm going to give them only so much storage, so many CPUs, so much memory, which will encourage them to behave in a way that they don't waste those resources. So maybe they're using the lightweight interface so when they are done deploying and working with a virtual machine, they want to go put it back in the library for another 6 months till they get to a new release cycle. So with System Center 2012 App Controller, we can give them an interface where they can do exactly that. They can come out and look at their services. They can look at their virtual machines. You know, I'm harping on services. You know, there are organizations that use App Controller that maybe just aren't ready for services. And it's not that they don't like the service concept. It's just not time for them in their process to adopt services. So you will have a natural tipping point, you know, maybe a process refresh where moving into the world of services makes perfect sense. I've seen that recently with DBAs where they said, you know what, we're 6 weeks behind. This looks like something that could help us out.
Cool. Well, one question related to App Controller here. Can you talk a little bit about quota points here? And, you know, making sure that basically a particular user doesn't consume too many resources that that individual user or that group of users should have.
Wow, so that's a great question and somebody taking me way back. So I think we're kicking it old school with quota points there. So the quota points are just one of five dimensions of cloud capacity. So we still support quota points in VMM 2012. So I'm going to get into quotas with you. So you're looking at the quota UI for the asker of that question. And you'll see that we can define custom quota in points. This is that legacy support for quota points as you know it. And what I liked about quota points was it gave me the ability to put to assign a relative resource weight for a virtual machine. You know, for example, my web servers were typically 4, and my SQL database servers were 10 or 12. And so I tried to come up with mathematical combinations that made it unlikely somebody could not use exactly the cloud capacity I gave them. So that's much easier now because I now have 5 dimensions of cloud capacity. So I can use quota points if I want. I find that we don't, frankly, much anymore because we have all of these other capabilities. I can define a max number of CPUs. If I have a large number of hosts out there, VMware, Hyper-V, it might be easier for me to just divide this fabric up as a percentage of the whole. You know, I have 3 departments that sponsor this. They're living together. I just divide it by 3 and say, okay, you each get 256, 256, 256. I can sort out the memory and cap the memory. I can cap storage. I can even cap the raw number of virtual machines. So maybe I want to keep this simple for me. I don't care what you deploy. You can deploy as many virtual machines as you want. And that is my only, you know, my only setting. So however you want to do this, that makes sense. You know, the other important thing, you know, the other important consideration when you're establishing quota is that nobody likes a resource hog, and everybody has a resource hog. Somebody that gets
that guy, right?
I'm that guy. So you know, deploying too many virtual machines when we have one person that takes 80% of the capacity and he or she is 20% of the whole, we get some hurt feelings. And we want to avoid that. So what we can do is not only establish role-level quotas, but we can establish member-level quotas. So I can tie that user down to, you know, on a per-user basis, everybody within that group to a specific percentage of the capacity or a portion of the capacity, same 5 elements of capacity here. And I keep mentioning that, you know, PowerShell is a succinct language and VMM is very PowerShell-friendly. You'll notice that View Script button. If you've not ever clicked that before, click it when you get to one of these UIs, and it gives you more PowerShell than you need, actually. I tend that I find, you know, I take this script, and I can take it and scale it back and add some parameters. It's a nice way to borrow a script, except I'm really just borrowing my own script. I don't have to go, you know, bing it on the internet and find a script. It's just right here for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. You know, we see people, let's say they want to go and adjust these quotas across dozens of different groups, dozens of different hosts. By taking the script, you know, saving it, reapplying it and rerunning it through PowerShell, that gives you the ability to kind of, you know, basically go through these wizards, these GUI-based wizards, but fully automated, kind of speeding up the time so you don't have to click everywhere as well.
And as we move through the process, you know, I'm going to continually focus on the UI basis of most of our automation here, but PowerShell is still has a place. And if you know PowerShell, it's going to serve you well now and in the future for sure.
Excellent. So as we wrap it up, before we get to the summary, one final question that I get. Question is, can I run these different system center components in a virtualized environment? Can I run these system center components in VMs?
So the answer is yes. The short answer is yes. I don't want to keep you waiting. But it's so rare that I see system center deployed to physical components. I had a conversation recently about 6 weeks ago with an organization that wanted to deploy to physical servers because they actually had some element of sort of chargeback in their environment, and he didn't want a virtualized system center because he said those will actually cost me. And he was talking about resources, and I kept saying, well, give it this many vCPUs and this much memory. And after his third attempt, he stopped me and said, no, you don't understand. I'm deploying to physical servers. So I had to sort of do a reset mentally and go back to a world we don't think about much, because every system center component is in fact supported for virtualization.
Absolutely, and I mean, you get those virtualization benefits, right? You can run it as a VM on a cluster, so you get high availability. You could get mobility by being able to live migrate those VMs across different hosts. So you get a lot of flexibility by running them in VMs. There may be one exception I see a lot of customers deploy on bare metal, and that's with Virtual Machine Manager, simply because in this release of 2012, it now supports clustering running directly on bare metal. So using this, you get some faster performance, and you can actually fail over that Virtual Machine Manager instance across different physical hosts. But by default, go put in a virtual machine, fully supported, runs great.
Yeah.
Now, as we wrap it up, what's our summary? What's our takeaways as part of this module?
Yep. So I think the short story here is go ask those questions. You know, determine who you're building for and to what specifications and what services really speak to them in that phase one. You know, everybody has a lengthy wish list, so find those quick wins that we can build in a reasonable amount of time as we get comfortable with the technology ourselves. You don't have to be a System Center expert to get started. It all begins with a single step, right? And think about that interface. You begin with the end in mind. You know, how am I going to present this to my end user? And what does all of this portend, you know, in terms of availability and performance in my cloud fabric? So when we go forward to that building of the fabric, we have an idea really of which Server 2012 features we're going to take advantage of as we move into that area that might require high availability or high scale or not. You know, we don't want to deploy a feature just for the sake of deploying, right? So this is going to give us a great roadmap for applying our needs to the technology so we can leverage the features that make sense for what it is we're trying to deliver to our customers.
Sounds great. Well, thanks a lot. That was a great summary, a great intro module. And we'll be back very shortly where we're going to be covering actually building this cloud fabric. So a lot of focus on our networks, our virtualization. So stay tuned. We'll be back shortly. Thank you.